Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week my guest is the journalist Ed West, who's the deputy editor of Unheard. And his new book is called Small Men on the Wrong Side of History, which is, well, it's a book about conservatives, who we like here at The Spectator, but it starts from a slightly defensive point of view, because, Ed, if I understand your starting point of your book right, you're essentially saying you think that you are a dying breed.
Yes, it's quite a pessimistic book. It's a mixture of sort of memoir, politics, history, current affairs. I wrote it in the style, because I find politics books quite boring, and I find politics quite boring a lot of the time, and it becomes too shouty, and people just end up just making these sermons about the other side and how awful they are, and I find it very off-putting, even from my own side, in fact, especially so. So I wanted to write it more from a personal account, just to make it seem more human. So that was partly the reason. But the underlying theme is that the culture war is sort of more like a reformation. Or the analogies I use are the reformation and the Christian takeover of Rome, and with a sort of losing side in both these instances, the Catholics in the reformation or the pagans in Rome. We are basically losing. And so that's my entire story.
I mean, what you say, I know, in the beginning, which is sort of very eye-catching and curious, is you say, look, it's never really been cool to be a teenage Tory, and that's obtained for, I don't know, at least 100 years or so. But it used to be the case that as a cohort aged, you know, the cliche about, you know, if you're not a socialist when you're a teenager, you have no heart, and if you're not a, you know, conservative when you're middle aged, you have no head, or whatever. You know, the idea was that cohorts would age into conservatism. You say that's not happening now.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but I started writing the book really about 8 or 9 years ago, thinking about it, because I saw that the people my age in my social network, who tended to be centre-left because, you know, I went to university, you know, I grew up in London and now I sort of worked in the media, were not becoming at all conservative. And even when they had adopted quite conservative lifestyles, the most obvious one, having families, they were in many ways even more liberal. They weren't necessarily sort of socialist in their views, but they were still very hostile to conservatism, and it wasn't this cohort movement. And I began to look into the studies of the different generations, and the evidence from America especially, but also from Britain, is that the current generation, if you're born from the late 70s onwards, that kind of shift isn't happening at all. People are staying, they still identify as being liberal or progressive, even as they enter their 40s, and even if they have children, but especially not if they don't have children. And that's something that's slightly new. And if you look at the voting habits of people, so I started writing the book around 2011, but after the last election, then I really started doing it full time, because at that point I really noticed how, if you're under 45, the Tories are just completely repulsive to most people. And no one in my social circle, except me, basically, was voting Tory. I mean, I live in quite an unusual
area. But why do you think this is happening? I mean, is this just a sort of genius move by Tony Blair and Barack Obama to make, you know, progressivism or liberalism seem cool?
No, because, I mean, most of the coolest people are liberals on the left. There's no denying that. We can't compete in any way on that thing. I mean, Barack Obama is just the latest, you know, Tony Blair, early Tony Blair before the whole war thing. You know, sort of everyone from Mandela to Humphrey Bogart on the left, and they're all cool than us. But I think there has been a sort of a generational cultural shift since the big cultural changes really began in the 60s and really hit much harder in the 80s and 90s. Now we're sort of the children and the grandchildren of that cultural change. And that cultural change was towards liberalism, and that has become the sort of establishment now. I mean, a huge factor is the decline of religion. I think this religion keeps people quite conservative for various reasons. In America, the atheists are really starting to win now in America amongst the younger generation. They are really falling out of religion. And when people stop having religion...
Is that true across the across demographics? Coastal elite thing?
Well, no, amongst even like the Mormons now are starting to see a real shift, losing people. amongst Americans born under 35, there is huge decline in religion, and you know what they call nuns, which is no religion. And so when people, I think when people start, you know, it's a cliche that progressivism is a sort of religion by another means, and all sorts of political movements have been described as religion, but people need a sort of default moral anchor. And so when Christianity is not that default moral anchor, if you meet anyone who's vaguely, who is like under the age of 45 or 50, who has a sort of strong sense of social justice, if they're not Christian, they're likely to be quite left-wing, if they have sort of moral anchor amongst them. And so that just makes it very, very hard to be a conservative in a lot of social circles. So we start to shrink in number. And those of us who are conservatives just keep our mouths shut because no one likes to be hated, right?
No. Well, some people do.
A few people, yes.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's part of the problem. Some people who like being hated then end up coming to the fore and they become the representatives of, you know, conservatism, the people with the sort of least amount of shame. And obviously Donald Trump was the most obvious classic example of that. He's saying that someone was basically zero likable qualities in him.
Yes, well, I mean, you do say, like, you know, the liberals, the progressives, the lefties are sort of taking over the world, winning the argument, we're all dying out. But at the same time, in actual power...
In power, yeah.
We're seeing something the opposite.
In terms of my book sales, Corbyn's defeat was totally... Like, I was obviously quite pleased Corbyn thought that, wow, Corbyn, you've really damaged me. But no, I mean, my argument is conservatives win elections and lose everything else. So there has been, you know, 10 years of Tory MPs in Downing Street. I mean, obviously 3 or 4 years have been completely taken up with this whole referendum business. But the people in power and the machineries of government is still overwhelmingly left of centre. You know, if you look at all the bodies that control how government actually works, if you look at, you know, the elite positions in universities, the media, education, and the influential industries, they're still, and probably even more so, left of centre than they were 10 years ago. You know, the Conservatives appointed, I think, basically two people to bodies during their entire last 10 years, and they sacked both of them after sort of Twitter storms. While in the meantime, while Labour in power, you see sort of Labour supporters get into positions of influence and they stay in those positions of influence. So most bodies, most institutional bodies in Britain are still
a big sort of conservative, it was a sort of progressive cake with conservative icing on it.
Yes, well, the Conservative Party right now, because we're going through a sort of realignment, they're on economic issues, they're becoming much more left-centre. That kind of makes perfect sense. On social issues, they are also still moving broadly to the left. I mean, you know, that's better than the alternative. But, I mean, a lot of this is because the Corbyn is a sort of black swan, this, because it always happened that Eric Joyce had this fight in Parliament, and then Corbyn ended up leader of Labour, and then we've gone through this weird parallel time zone. I think if it wasn't
Eric Joyce's fight in Parliament kicked all this off.
Oh, that's a great theory. It all began because Eric Joyce said that Parliament, and because of that, Ed Miliband changed the rules, and then there's a whole...
The punch that went around the world.
Yeah, basically. He's the friendship of the modern era. But the thing about Trump was a sort of reaction to this. So at the end of my book, I deal with the sort of reaction. Trump has got support amongst a demographic who feel under fire and feel like they're losing, but they are also a very much a dying demographic. Now, so Labour are in a terrible mess at the moment, but the Tories are also, in the long term, still got bigger problems because their supporters are very, very old. You know, and what happens to old people in 20 years' time is that they're no longer with us. So they have still got a lot to do because the generation coming up are still going to be even more probably left liberal than the ones in power right now because they would have been exposed to almost no conservative ideas. You know, most of their teachers will be left centre, etc., etc. So in 20 years' time, the Tories are still going to have huge problems, even if they are sort of functioning in power for the next few years, which they probably will be.
Now, as someone who's on the more kind of hand-wringing liberal end of the spectrum myself, what I sort of wonder, you know, but obviously lots of my friends and colleagues are conservatives and I don't respect them. Why is it, do you think, at the moment, you know, it seems to me one of the problems is that you're, you know, in any of these sort of battles, each team has a series of kind of really prominent sort of centre forwards, if you like. And the sort of poster boys and poster girls for conservatism or for, you know, what we broadly call right-wing ideas seem quite often to the sort of as objective as possible observer to be people who are either self-interested, hypocritical, power-crazed, trolly, ignorant, obnoxious. You know, you look at the sort of the Trumps, the Katie Hopkinses, the, you know, Tucker Carlson's, the, you know, these are the sort of centre forwards for conservatism. You know, where are the Roger Scrutons and the Oakeshotts and the?
Well, I mean, I would defend Tucker. I think Tucker's pretty. He's a very interesting guy, and I I'm a bit of a fan. I would say in terms of, I mean, the thing with Trump and the Hopkins thing is that if an idea becomes so repulsive and people who have those ideas are shamed, then by nature the sort of people who rise to the top are those, the shameless individuals. I mean, there is also a problem that people, the psychological differences between people, liberals and conservatives, liberals tend to have, be more inclined towards the arts because they have, they're higher in openness, the personality traits. So you're going to find more people with those kind of qualities. I mean, that's the main reason things like academia and acting are always going to be left centre. It's not sort of institutional bias. It's just the way it is. And I suppose conservatism is, in Britain anyway, is particularly focused in this kind of reactive tabloid fight back mentality. And in the US, the same things happen with shock jock. So, you know, so it starts to appeal to a certain kind of man, and it tends to be men who feel, you know, like, you know, I can't drive my car because they're putting speed limits, and I'm, you know, I'm the PC Brigade are, you know, stopping me doing whatever I like. And it's kind of developed that kind of barroom mentality, because that's, I suppose, the way to sell newspapers, or that's the way to get elected. It's not necessarily the best thing for conservatism generally.
No, it seems to be kind of bad PR sort of thing. You know,
it's bad PR. But, I mean, I think even if you're quite gentlemanly, you know, the thing with Scruton was a very gentlemanly man and a very thoughtful man, but his ideas are still repulsive to most liberals, most progressives. If you actually look, you know, beyond the architecture, he still wouldn't be accepted amongst them as a sort of, as an okay guy. I was fine, you can talk to us because you're really intelligent and you like classical music. You know, you're still off the scales.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things your book does that's attractive is you kind of delve back a bit to talk about what conservatism is and isn't and its origins. And you line up these sort of little binaries, like, you know, Team Augustine versus right, Team Pelagius, Team, you know, Hobbes versus Team
Rousseau. I've
got a
very simple conservative mind. I need everything to be binary. Black and white.
You know, Burke and Payne, you know, yeah. You've got this. But it strikes me a little. Do you think conservatism is a sort of intellectual position or a habit of mind? Because you seem to suggest that in some ways there is a sort of, you know, it's a proclivity of personality.
Yeah, I think it's a mixture. There is the intellectual tradition, which both, I look at that, and that goes back to the 18th century as a starting point for ideology. And conservatism, in a way, was a sort of way of opposing religious. Now we talk about the religious right, but as a way of opposing religious enthusiasm, as it was called in the 17th
century. Which is the sort of extreme Protestant sect.
Well, yes, Puritanism is sort of, it's this idea that if the there should be rule by the godly, because that was against the social hierarchy. And so the conservatives like Hume and Burke were responding to that, and they were articulating a conservative philosophy, that one that wasn't really based on religious instruction. Even though I think all politics basically comes down to religion, that's why it's like Augustine and original sin. I mean, and in that sense, that's where the overlap comes with personality types. Because if you're more pessimistic and more inclined to see people as inherently bad and, you know, barbarian, then you are more likely to be conservative. And, you know, I look at Augustine's miserable view of the world as being doom and gloom, and I think, well, I kind of agree with that.
Yes.
And I think it's like liberals tend to have a more optimistic view of the world and tend to think we're sort of by nature good and it's only society, man, you know. So then I bring Rousseau, who's, I think, probably one of the most evil people in history. And I think his ideas...
Paul Johnson did a good job on him, didn't he?
Oh, brilliant. Paul Johnson's thing was fantastic. The great assassination of his character. But when I was growing up, his ideas were quite big in influence education, and that was very much sort of the late 60s to 80s thing.
Rousseau was the man who's born free, but everywhere is in chains.
Yeah, and he was just an awful, awful human being. And, you know, he did the classic sort of liberal man of, you know, he left his girlfriend pregnant and said, oh, you go and deal with it. And when it's a series of just using people and exploiting them. And so, yeah, so there
was Alexander Herzen, the Russian, who said, fish are born to fly, yet everywhere we find them in water. Good conservative retort.
Yeah, so the conservatives tend to be gloomy and doomy. You know, Hobbes being another predecessor who's... view is that, you know, life is sort of brutish and short, so unless we have a sort of strong order to keep things. It's temperaments of conservatives v liberals, but also there's the origin in religion and the sort of the religious conflicts in Europe. And so we see, you know, the Puritans and the high Anglicans becoming the Whigs and the Tories, and I sort of go through that, and so that becomes modern liberalism and conservatism until you have like the more extreme ideologies of the modern world.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points you make, which I think is one of the most attractive things about conservatism, is this idea that it's, you know, it's not about hanging on to the past for the past's sake or obeying, you know, existing structures just because they're there, but the sort of sense that, you know, you would have a default respect for things that are already in place.
Right, yeah.
Even if they don't seem very reasonable because,
you know, there's a reason why they've lasted all these years.
Yeah, to sort of, what is it, keep a good hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse kind of thing.
Also, yeah, Chesterton's fence, also called, you know, you see a fence and you might not know why it's there, but you take it away and the ball comes and charges you. There's a institutions. I mean, that's the biggest mistake people think about conservatism is they confuse it with what Jerry Muller, you know, describes as orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is the idea that there's a preordained sort of way of life that's been usually for religious reasons, and therefore nothing must change. You know, so that a critic of conservatism might say, "Oh, well, you'd rather we're still sort of stuck in, I don't know, cutting heads off and sacrificing them to the sun god or something." But conservatism isn't about things staying the same. It's just about mainly the chief thing is institutions, institutional proof. An institution has survived all this time, so it probably has some good function. And even if the origins of the institutions might be slightly dubious, you know, it's that old silly argument, oh, the Church of England, Henry VIII was divorced like twice and killed two wives. It's like, well, all institutions are started by quite bad guys. I mean, the royal family is a great example. It's institutional, has great proof. It's a very, very effective system. And when the Queen and the next king are crowned, you know, we all pretend that to believe, if we don't, that, you know, God has sort of appointed them sovereign, even though their ancestors were just the best at fighting or just happened to be Protestant in this case. You know, we all know, we all put that to the back of our mind. The institutions might have started in slightly shady ground.
But who is it you quote? I mean, I think it might be Burke you quote to the effect that institutions kind of mellow into...
Right, yeah, that's Burke. I quote Burke like 100 times.
He's obviously...
He's the prophet.
He's the great man. Yeah. But, you know, one of the points you make is, look, we tend to respect things that are there, but, you know, we can do without, for example, you know, stoning adulteresses to death or, you know, sacrificing people to the sun god and so forth. I mean, how do you decide which ones to get rid of in the conservative mind? You know, which of the inheritances? Because you say, you know, we don't believe in this sort of utopian projects to smash everything and build it from the ground up. But obviously there are some things that you go, actually, you know, fair enough.
I suppose the mainstream conservative view would be just that pragmatism is we start from the... I suppose it's the burden of proof. The burden of proof has to be on the people showing that change is good. I mean, one of the things, I suppose one of the core issues that comes through during this period I cover, is gay marriage. And it's one thing a lot of conservatives were unhappy with, but then there were also quite conservative arguments for making it. So it was one interesting thing that tested that question about, okay, the marriage has been successful as it is, why change it? But then say, well, actually, these are people buying into an institution. So there are conservative arguments both ways. And I was working at a Catholic magazine at the time, so it was tend to be quite against it. But there also, it kind of came on basic Christian ideas of individualism and love and the marriage being a sort of recognition of that institution. But I think that the basic cop-out would be it was just a matter of pragmatism, you know, which don't start with the premise that something has to go because it seems irrational or out of date, but show how it can be adapted or it can be... we can do without this maybe small change. Because all conservatives, I mean, even the worst revolutions have some good things. I mean, no one wouldn't say that, oh, the French Revolution, I would say it's probably overall is a bad thing. You know, you beheaded hundreds and thousands of people. But yeah, okay, the metric system is probably better than having 24 different standards. Of,
like, yes, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, you know.
But yeah, exactly. That was the show.
I mean, the gay marriage is a good instance. I mean, again, from the point of view of the sort of liberal blob, you go, all right, we can see that there's a very good case for, you know, market liberalism and for many of the things that conservatives stand for. But how come semi-infallibly over the last 40 or 50 years of social change, effectively the conservative disposition has more often than not ended up on the sort of, if you like, nasty party side of things that are now come to be accepted to do with, you know, racial equality, various aspects of social justice, you know, gay marriage, all that?
I don't know. There are lots of issues where things have turned back. I mean, education has gone back much more towards the conservative idea. Crime, I mean, crime in the US particularly, the kind of 60s ideas about crime were completely abandoned because they were obviously seen as quite bad. I mean, conservatism is... I mean, I think it's partly because we've just lost the frame of the argument on so many things, and so we're inevitably going to be cast as baddies. And in some cases, we kind of almost want to be cast as baddies, I think, in this great sort of drama, this morality tale. I think, you know, I mentioned how I saw, you know, the Lincoln film, and to me it seemed like a perfect analogy for the liberal. I think of this like an American vision of the world. You know, we move towards better, more tolerant world, and this was slavery, and now there's gay marriage, and I suppose now it'll be the trans debate. I don't know how that's going to end. I don't know. We would say we'd probably lost the argument, but I'd also say that conservatives mostly didn't have nasty opinions on these things. They just had either slow down opinions or they had sort of more moderate views in some cases, but we've still come to lose it in the public mind.
Now, there's a sort of... Well, there are a couple of kind of junction points in history that you bring up, one of which, and I don't want this podcast suddenly to sound like a sort of, you know, really dull A-level history lesson, but the Corn Laws being perhaps the first... the dread words, the Corn Laws, tariff reform and imperial preference. But the Corn Law row seemed to herald a kind of split in conservatism that seems to be going on to this day. There's a sort of market.
Unfortunately, it's very, very... It's as unsexy as history gets. It's, you know, if you've got the Tudors and the Nazis at one end, the Corn Law is...
It's up there.
If anyone's actually listening to this right now, please stick with us.
Please Google Corn Laws. They're fascinating.
I think I managed to avoid the Corn Laws in history, but then I did start reading them after this latest unfortunate business of the last 4 years when we've all been in each other's throats. And the parallels are incredibly relevant, aren't they? They're very striking. It's between a largely rural base on one side who are losing to a sort of growing demographic who are like the cities and the sort of smart set, the Whig liberal elite. And there are lots of parallels with our modern world. I mean, in many ways, we are sort of now going back to a more Tory v Whig conflict in politics, where we've had sort of class-based conflicts for about a century and a half, which is sort of largely working-class socialists against a sort of middle-class alliance of liberals and conservatives. And now we're going much more back to the sort of the Whig mercantile elites in the cities versus the more rural sort of Tory party who... And the Tories always called themselves in the 18th century, they were the party of the people against the courts. It's the same thing. It would be like, I don't know, modern-day economists talking about the liberal elite. I mean, there's literally nothing new under the sun. It's always the same old story. But yeah, those parallels are...
But there's that sort of fissure, isn't there, between the... I mean, because conservatism has become a term that sort of seems to rope in a sort of social tendency towards, you know, people need to behave in a certain way that's prescribed, you know, and just sort of liberal, so, you know, social liberalism, we all think, you know, do what you like as long as you don't frighten the horses.
Yeah.
And yet economic liberalism has become the great kind of conservative thing. I mean, those two things seem to tug against each other a bit.
Yeah, it's called, I mean, David Willetts called it a conservative dilemma, and they are in complete contradiction. And one of the things that's happening now is that, you know, what people... It's in the States, it's called the Great Realignment, where politics is moving, is completely shifting. So the old two alliances are breaking apart so that we're having a more conservative party on both sides of the Atlantic, which is much more economically left-wing because it represents a much more working-class constituency. And then you have a left-wing party, which is becoming... You know, I hate the word because it's so overused. Neoliberal, it's sort of... socially liberal and economically liberal. And that's slightly not happened in Britain because of what's happened to the Labour Party, but that is the general trend, which in a sense kind of makes more sense because even in history, some of the, you know, the early economic radicals in Britain around the time of the Luddites were very conservative. They were people trying to hold on to their economic status and their way of life against the modernisation of industrialisation. So there's no reason why that doesn't really make sense in one way. Because, you know, modern day conservative in the kind of Thatcherite mold is a contradiction in a sense. I mean, kind of, the free market destroys everything that conservatives love.
Well, eventually. Exactly. I mean, there's that thing, you know, you talk very eloquently about how, you know, at its root, conservatives, and sort of Burke being, again, a prime example, says, you know, most people's loyalties naturally are, you know, stronger the more local they are.
Right. Yeah.
And so you're not being Little England a nationalist if you believe that those sorts of units.
Sure, I mean, I think it's
reasonable,
just,
but you know, the great movement of capital and free markets are presumably what works against that.
Yeah, and I mean, that is the main reason the Conservatives have lost is that we've basically become a lot richer. And so, I mean,
more international. I mean,
rich, exactly, rich in one session. Those two things kind of go hand in hand. The more international become, the more richer, and vice versa. I mean, I look at the some cultural, political influences in the 50s, 60s, but when it comes down to it, I think just the more rich we become, the more liberal. So conservatism has therefore become a sort of minority, an anti-view of the current world. I mean, I think that the interesting thing will be, you know, the party post-Brexit. How do you square those two things?
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I became even more pessimistic about the Brexit thing, because I just think, how are they going to possibly satisfy their new supporters while, you know, having this whole global Britain buccaneering thing, which they keep going about.
Yeah, they're riding two horses with one ass. Yeah.
Someone's going to end up really angry and disappointed, but, you know, fine.
Well, that's the new normal, isn't it? I mean, how conservative do you think the team we've got in Downing Street is?
Interesting question. I mean, my natural instinct is to say not very in many ways, but that's just a sort of cliche, grumbling, right-wing columnist thing to say, isn't it? Because they're never going to be happy about the whole thing. I mean, the Conservative Party is an alliance between Conservatives and Liberals, and it always has been. So there's room for sort of social Conservatives, and there's room for, like, Liz Truss, and, you know, who wants us all to be using Uber and whatever.
No, but I mean, the sort of Cummings project to, you know, remake the civil service and...
Yeah, know, I mean, Cummings is an interesting guy, because he's a sort of... At the end, I sort of talk about when the institutions start to rot, or when the institutions start to become inherently liberal, which is what happens to our society, then conservatism itself becomes kind of revolutionary, and it has this kind of revolutionary conservative, this idea of smashing everything up. And I think Dominic Cummings has a bit of that. And some of Trump's advisors, like Stephen Miller, they all sort of quite into that. They want to remake the whole thing by knocking down all these frail, old, liberal-controlled institutions. The BBC is a classic example of that. I mean, I think those kind of, that side, I mean, I think Cummings definitely is a conservative, more so than Boris, Boris is an old-fashioned sort of small L liberal conservative, which is, I think, nothing wrong with that. They're probably the least harm of any political leaders imaginable.
Yeah, no, there's no judgment here.
Safe space.
A safe space. Now, but can you talk about the roots of your own conservatism? Because you describe, you know, being a sort of teenager reading Roger Scruton and, you know, Roger Scruton and Spider-Man. And Oswald Spengler and Spider-Man, you describe yourself as reading detective.
The Spengler thing was a joke, by the way. I've actually never got around to reading it. No, well, my parents were sort of bohemian conservatives. As I mentioned, they were quite eccentric people. My dad was he'd sort of started off as a communist when he was a teenager. That was after the war, and it's also very fashionable. But then he became a foreign correspondent, and he became increasingly reactionary. And he was in Africa after decolonization, and he became sort of very sort of pessimistic about everything. And so when I was growing up, he was a complete... I mean, he didn't believe in democracy anymore. He did think the Great Reform Act was a terrible mistake, and things... You know, it's like Thomas Carlyle, who's a great hero, that everything had gone downhill since the 14th century. And he used to say these things, and I don't know if it was a joke or... if it was half a joke or if he actually meant that. He said,
you tell a lovely story about him visiting Nicaragua during the...
Oh, right, yeah. He was in the war, and he was with a friend of his, an old deceased journalist called Peter Kemp, and they were surrounded by a mob. My dad spoke, surrounded by a communist mob, and Dad spoke very fluent Spanish, and he was scared, and he said, well, you know, to think you're speaking to a veteran of the Spanish Civil War like that, and they all sort of quieted down. And he said, well, you know, we managed to get out of there. And he said he didn't explain to them which side of the Spanish War before he actually fought. He was one of 12 people to volunteer for Franco, which is very, very unusual. Has sort of less kind of glamour, doesn't it, than sort of George Orwell?
A little bit less, but that's all right. But also, you yourself, as someone who avowedly says that you think that, you know, the age we should all go back to is about 1911, you're practically a kind of Marxist compared to him if he's the 14th century.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, your family trajectory is very much in the liberal direction.
Yeah. I mean, so my children will, I don't know, maybe accept the 70s, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. They'll actually move forward. Can you talk a bit about how you see the culture wars now? Because that does seem to be a realignment of some sort. There's this very... I mean, you yourself said, maybe I've got a note of... sort of one regret in it. You said, you know, I've been one of those, you know, edgelord
columnists.
Oh, yeah,
I feel completely regretful. I find it very, very tedious and shouty. I mean, it's just awful. I mean, I partly wrote this book, really, I mean, the main reason I start was after reading Jonathan Haidt's book on The Righteous Mind, on why people fall out over politics and why they end up really angry about politics. And I used to be one of those people. And reading that was basically the start of this book, because I realised, you know, I'd quite like to explain to myself why I'm conservative, because I'd really rather not be, because most of my friends are liberals, and I wish I wasn't like this. And I wish I wouldn't get angry about other people's views when I just think they're wrong, they don't understand, they're idiots. And after a while, I just think this is really pointless, a really silly way to spend your time. And I think it's getting caught up in, you know, David Brooks calls it the outrage industrial... It wasn't David Brooks, Arthur Brooks, sorry. The outrage industrial complex, which is just, you know, churning out these articles, getting... winding people up about the other side. And it's, you know, it's like a return to these Reformation
pamphlets. You worked for Spiked for a while, didn't you, which is part of the...
No, I've never... I've done, like, two articles of Spiked.
Oh, have you? Oh, right, sorry, I thought you were in a...
No, but I'm the kind of person who would... No, I was on Telegraph blogs. I mean, I ended that, then I wrote, did a lot of Spectator, but then, you know, Spectator were much different because they had said you can just write whatever you want, so I didn't really get angry about stuff anymore, so it was, I felt it was more measured. So
but, I mean, this does belong to both sides, doesn't it? This business that you become more interested in owning the libs or calling out the Nazis than you do in advancing an argument.
Yeah, because the vast majority of these articles are just about you winning over your own side, aren't you? So you... there's no incentive to actually... the number of people on the other side who are going to be won over by an argument is so tiny, it's not worth the effort involved in trying to make a complex argument. It's much better just to score points. And that's fine. I mean, that's the way of debates are done, but it's just kind of it's fruitless, and it also ends up as a sort of driving wedge in society. I mean, in the States, they're ahead of us, but I think we're catching up. Just the number of people who express a really serious dislike of people of the other side has massively increased in the last 20 years. You know, like the polls of people who think Republicans or the Democrats are, you know, not only don't have the best interests at heart, are less evolved or at danger as a country. These numbers, and, you know, I would not want my daughter or son to marry a member of this opposite party. They're now running at 50 or 60%. And Britain's catching up. I mean, the number of Remainers, so they wouldn't want to leave her as an in-law, went from about 15% to like 35% last year. I mean, these are really like heightened political... And I find it in conversations with people, which can't even talk about certain stuff because it's become so partisan. And that's why I think it's sort of a return to the sort of Reformation. It's just these pamphlets people are saying about, oh, this Catholic, but this counterblast the Romans, and this is what our politics has become. It's completely tribal.
No, we had a podcast guest who came in the other day with a necklace saying fuck the Tories,
right?
And our deputy editor said, well, that's very generous. Many people on your side won't even kiss one. But so what, how do we get back, do you think? I mean, how it's obviously quite a big question, but do you think there's a way of somehow, I don't know whether it's recreating the center ground or changing the way that debating is done?
I don't know. I'm Mr. Doom and Gloom. I can't offer solutions.
Do you think? You think we're just doomed to be standing in our echo chambers shrieking at each other's images forever?
I think so. I think it was one of Peter Hitchens' tweets, wasn't it? It said, I'm not here to save Britain, I'm just here to write the obituary. I'm a bit like that. I mean, there are, in the States, there are charities that try to get people to talk to members of the other side.
Peter's quite a good example, actually, of someone who says he doesn't quite identify as a conservative. I mean, he
appropriates
the badge of reactionary as a...
Yeah.
As a sort of badge of honour. And
I know. I mentioned him a couple of times in the book because he's someone who I think is really interesting and independent thinker, and he's someone we should have more of. But, I mean, back to your thing about why are we always the baddies, I think partly, I mean, I mentioned some of these studies that show that liberals tend to have a much less accurate idea of what conservatives think than vice versa.
Yeah.
And I wonder about that. I think part of it is that liberals are just more likely to hang around other liberals. But, you know, when Peter Hitchens says something that's not the classic standard sort of article of faith of conservatism, everyone says, wow, it's amazing, even Peter Hitchens says that. And, like, he's always said things like that. You know, he has lots of different views. Just you can't be bothered to find out what he thinks about stuff because he's a conservative, and therefore, who cares?
You assume.
Yeah, so I can just assume, you know, he sort of eats babies for breakfast, but...
No, well, it's a classic thing, isn't it, that conservatives think liberals are lewd and liberals think conservatives are evil.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that goes back to the 18th century, Malthus and Goodwin arguing, you know, and there's countless examples of that. I agree, there are some times we do play up to that. That's kind of inevitable, but there is a certain aspect that there is just sort of little interest in what conservatives think. And I think partly a lot of it's just down to urbanism. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, in America, you know, the cities are very liberal, the countryside is more rural, and Britain's overwhelmingly urban. That's partly why we're more liberal than the States. But as cities grow, people become more liberal, and as they become much more intensely liberal, and there are fewer conservatives in them. So you, in a way, cities are sort of less open-minded than small towns in a strange way. I mean, I use the example, my mum lives in a small town in Kent. You know, the people, her neighbours and people she chats to every day are from a vastly more different, diverse backgrounds than the people I know in North London. You know, they, I mean, her neighbours probably are all English, but they come from different social classes and they have different political beliefs. So literally almost everyone I will talk to in my area will have the same views or have the same educational background. And that's the partly the thing of urbanism makes us much more fit into our own little niches. So that amongst that is, you know, our own political niche. And social media is just like an extreme form of cities because you can just find all your own little groups. And that makes you more hostile to members of the out-group. It's kind of normal.
Well, you're a brave and lonely figure.
Thanks, I'm very...
North London. And thank you very much for
thank
coming
you very
and
much, sir.
Outing yourself. You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. Very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.